Please silence all electronic devices.
It's not just about the money. It's about how we organize education. It's about how we hire principals and create pipelines for good teachers, all that.
I mean, just to say, you know, $4 billion going for education is going to improve our education system. I need a lot more information about that and assurances that we're looking at outcomes.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. It is a Friday, the 13th, in fact. That means it's time again to review the week in state politics. Here, as usual, for the conversation, are Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch and Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation.
Hey there.
Happy Friday.
There is still another week in 2020 candidate filing. However, in recent days, some interesting developments. A couple of legislative rematches are taking shape. New Hanover County, Mecklenburg County, and a powerful House Republican will take a crack at becoming state superintendent. What stood out to you this week from candidate filings?
I was struck by the fact that gerrymandering still rules, it would appear. I mean, we're a week away from the closure of the candidate filings, but I did a quick count this morning. It's like 16 of 50 state Senate seats, there's still somebody running unopposed. 58 out of 120 House seats, we still only have one candidate. I mean, I guess we hope there will be some people announcing in the days to come, but that says to me that we're still, and in Congress, five members of the 13-member delegation running unopposed at this point. And, you know, even if somebody emerges, we pretty much already know the results. So I guess that's the thing that's most striking and most disappointing to me, is that gerrymandering, rigged elections still rule, and in many, many, many instances, the whole thing will be over by March when the primary is over, because there won't even be a viable challenger in November.
Well, as we move forward, several things have struck out to me. One, just to answer Rob's concerns about the gerrymandering, you know, one of the things that makes this difficult is where people choose to live makes the drawing of the districts hard. And so even with firm rules in place of equal representation, same number of people, contiguous, keeping counties whole, that kind of thing, you know, unless we start mandating where people are going to live, it's always going to be a challenge, you know, for
that.
One of the things, a couple things struck me. One is the changes in the congressional districts and the changes that were put in place by this latest round of redistricting that makes two of the reliably Republican districts are now leaning towards Democrats. And so what that's going to look like, who we're going to see. Deborah Ross is someone who I knew quite well when she was in the North Carolina House. Had kind of been wondering what's the next step in her political career after she ran for Senate against Richard Burr. Was interesting to see that she has filed for that seat. So many of the House members and members of the General Assembly filing for Council of State races has been quite interesting. And then the other thing that I would mention is we've seen several House members who are trying to move over to the Senate. Kevin Corbin is one of those. Lisa Barnes is another one that is filing for the Senate seat, leaving a House seat empty. So kind of what that musical chairs is going to look like through this election, I think is going to be pretty interesting and something to watch.
Also worth noting in the second congressional district in the Raleigh area, Wake County, that Monica Johnson Hostler, who's been running for a long time, actually, it's sort of a tortoise and the hare kind of situation. She was running even in the previous version of District 2 before it was run, but she's in a very strong, intelligent, capable African-American woman who's been running in that seat for a while. It'll be interesting to see how she and Ross, and we now got a former Obama aide who's also thrown his hat in the ring as well. So it'll be an interesting second district race.
One other thing that I just have to mention is the number of candidates, the people who have stepped up from Libertarian, Republican, Democrat, all these different races. One thing that has really struck me is the difficulty of running and serving nowadays. I wrote a column about this, about with the very divided partisan, with having to raise money, with the length of the sessions, with the intensity of the sessions, with the low pay for the sessions for these legislative races. Congratulations and thank you to all of the people who have filed to run for this so that we have choices and we have good debate and we have good discussion. But I don't know why any of them would, to be honest with you, these days.
Statewide candidates do make six-figure salaries. A couple of them come with the House, but those legislative demands are much more strenuous for much less pay. Rob, just to follow up on something you said off the top, I think, perhaps injecting a little optimism here, if 2018 was any indication, I think we're going to see almost every state house and state senate seat contested by the time that candidate filing is done.
There's been more of a concerted effort by both parties to recruit candidates, to get people in the race. I think you're right. It'll likely come to that point. But I still think it's concerning that we have several races where literally no one has actually filed yet. Again, there's a week to go, but you think that someone who was a serious candidate who had raised money, was trying to raise their profile, wouldn't wait around too long before they filed. So I still am very concerned that we're going to have a lot of non-competitive races. And I hear the critique that, yes, we can't tell people where to live. I still think it's clear we could do a lot more to make more of the races competitive. And if we have to look at how we draw districts in the future, or we have to come up with a system of multiple member districts or something else to try and get more competitive races, I still think that's something to continue to explore.
North Carolina needs to drastically increase school funding. That's the message from a report that was released this week by a nonprofit research group. WestEd found that the state is near the bottom of states nationally in terms of education spending, and that the lack of funding amounts to a violation of a constitutional obligation. And the group recommends an $8 billion increase in education spending over the next 8 years. Becky, other than a tax increase, is there a viable way to do that?
I think the only way you can do it is with a tax increase. I mean, that's an $8 billion increase, $1 billion a year over 8 years. But a couple things struck me that was really interesting in this report. And one is, even the report authors have conceded that there is no magic number, that putting a number with education outcomes is an art rather than a science. So with this report, there were also a lot of recommendations about reforms that the General Assembly has been looking at over the years. And I don't want the discussion of the report and the recommendations to be only about the money, because there's a lot of other things in there, too. There are things like looking at the school funding formula, ways to ensure that the money gets where it needs to be for the outcomes if we are going to, and constitutionally we have to, provide a sound basic education. So let's make sure that those kids that are in the lower part of that get the resources that they need. Other things like giving principals more autonomy to run their schools, again, to ensure that those outcomes are there in the schools where they need to be. So there's a lot of other things in this report rather than just the money. And I think if we just talk about the money, we're not really addressing the problems that need to be addressed.
I'm going to follow up on just the money for a second, though. Would you be okay with a tax increase if it were for $8 billion over 8 years and earmarked only for education appropriations?
Jeff, it depends on where that money goes. I mean, just to say, you know, $4 billion going for education is going to improve our education system. I need a lot more information about that and assurances that we're looking at outcomes and that money is going to be spent in ways that we know will provide that sound basic education and that opportunity for students in classrooms.
One of the most important things about this report that many people may not grasp is that this just isn't just some ordinary report by some researchers. It was actually mandated by the court that still has jurisdiction in the Leandro litigation that goes back 20-plus years in this state, in which 1997 our state Supreme Court ruled that every child in the state has a constitutional right to a sound basic education. And this is not just a passive responsibility on the state. It's an affirmative responsibility to go out and provide that. And what the researchers have found and what people have been testifying to for years is that we've actually been going backwards over the last couple of decades. We've been slashing our investments in public education. And that's part of the reason that the numbers getting thrown around are so large, because we have implemented billions of dollars in tax cuts on the wealthy and on profitable corporations over the last several years. We're even in a bigger hole than we ought to be. But the bottom line, I actually agree with a lot of what Becky said. It's not just about the money. It's about how we organize education. It's about how we hire principals and create pipelines for good teachers, all that. But you can't get around the central fact that North Carolina spends less per pupil than South Carolina now as a result of we've had a falling investment in public education for over a decade, and that's just exacerbated this problem. It was a problem created by Democrats and Republicans. It's going to take a bipartisan effort to get out of it. But the hope here is that this is actually going to be a court order. This is going to lead eventually, we think, to the state Supreme Court telling the General Assembly, you must do this. This is not something where they can just ignore the courts. They will actually be ordered, perhaps even under penalty of contempt, to fund these programs in a much more adequate way than we're doing right now.
I think there's a real danger on the courts going in and doing exactly what Rob has described. That would be a separation of powers crisis in this state.
I don't think so. The
General Assembly is the entity that is constitutionally authorized to appropriate money.
But the courts order state leaders to do things all the time. If the General Assembly had, for instance, appropriated money to create an officially segregated school system, the legislature could be told, you can't do that anymore. The courts can order the legislature to do all kinds of things. The courts
determine what the Constitution means. Not appropriate money. I mean, that is clearly a separation of powers issue, and one that I think would lead to a constitutional crisis, and one that would lead to lawsuits and just lots of problems.
But to hammer down, the court wouldn't be appropriating money, but you're saying if the court ordered the appropriation of money, that would be a violation of the judiciary.
So I think that we need to be very careful with this. But before, I mean, what my hope would be is that, and let's be clear too, the report has been submitted to the court. The court now has been reviewing it. They've had that report for well over a month.
Right. I think they've had it since June. It just became public on Tuesday, to get opinions on it
and that kind of thing. The question now is, what do they do with that report? At this point, it's only a list of suggestions that this group West Ed has submitted to the court. What do they do with it now? What do the parties to this lawsuit do? And I think that there's just a real danger and a real question of, Jeff, as you mentioned, you know, that the courts don't say to the General Assembly, you must appropriate $8 billion, or you must spend this much, or you must do those kind of things. What I hope is that with these reform recommendations that are also in the report, many of these the General Assembly has been looking at for a number of years, that this leads to a further conversation. We've been talking about education and how best to deliver this. You know, Rob mentioned decades. I would argue it's probably gone on longer than that. With 57% of our state budget dedicated to education, I think anybody, any leader that you talk to across North Carolina, education is a very high priority. So, you know, I mean, I think what we need is this to lead to a really productive discussion rather than mandates being issued as a result of one report that's been submitted to the court.
Well, again, there's precedent for this happening in other states. It's a model that's been followed where the court orders a report, the report comes forth, and it lays out a roadmap for what the court is actually going to implement. This is a constitutional mandate, and there's only one way to enforce it if the legislature is not going to comply with the constitutional mandate, and that is for the courts to order them to do that. That happens all the time in lots of different areas. I'm not saying that the court is necessarily going to come in and order a tax increase, but they may say, look, we're going to have to provide this basic level of funding for every school in our state and every child in our state in order for us to even have a chance of providing them a true, sound, basic education. And if the legislature is not going to comply with the court order, yeah, that's a constitutional crisis. And I think it's would be a dire mistake on the part of legislative leaders not to do what a court orders them to do.
Let's turn our attention to Chapel Hill for an update on the latest battle in another culture war. A lawsuit was threatened this week. It would challenge the $2.5 million settlement between UNC Chapel Hill and the Sons of the Confederacy. Also, a report indicated that the settlement could put some federal grant money at risk. Then, today, this morning, Interim Chancellor Kevin Guskowitz was able to shed the temporary title. Seems to me he's been stuck between a rock and a hard place, the UNC Board of Governors, and furious students and faculty. Smells as though this thing is destined for a court battle. Where do you think it goes next?
Well, we've already had indications from civil rights groups that they will be intervening in the lawsuit on behalf of clients to challenge this settlement. The idea of paying $2.5 million to a white supremacist group, it's also having, beyond just people being outraged, you talk about federal funding, we've had the Mellon Foundation come out and say we're already pulling $1.5 million in funding that we were going to give to the university. We're having widespread calls from alumni to ask for donations to the university system to be halted. I think that this is something that's just getting underway. It's sparked a real widespread outrage amongst the whole University of North Carolina system community against this idea of providing money in this way. Also, I think it's worth, just as an aside, looking to see, instead of this idea of giving money to white supremacy groups, to look what the state of Virginia did this week, which was they actually unveiled a new statue in downtown Richmond that featured an African-American individual, really sort of an answer to the white supremacist monuments that dot downtown Richmond. And that's something – that's the kind of productive solutions perhaps that we ought to be doing instead of just handing out cash to white supremacist groups.
I think I think the whole situation with Chapel Hill with this $2.5 million, I think it's a big mess. I think there were honest attempts to try to find some sort of resolution to this. I don't think this has turned out to be the best solution. But I agree with Robin. You know, we talked about this before. I think more information, more documentation, more monuments, more revealing of what our history is the way to go rather than less of it. So I agree. I think we need more of that. I don't see a way out of this mess. It just seems to be escalating. And perhaps the way to do it is to have the courts step in and to make some sort of, you know, for them to come up with some sort of resolution on it.
Yeah, and the only point I would make is that the lawsuit that was filed by the Sons of Confederate Veterans is demonstrably and widely accepted as being completely illegitimate. They have no standing to bring the lawsuit. It would have been dismissed out of hand if they had brought it without having entered into these discussions ahead of time. And so I think that
and I just want to pause real quick, 30 seconds. I think our listeners are very smart. I think most of them are smarter than I am. But when you say standing, just expound a little bit further, because they didn't own the statue, because
there was this theory that somehow, because this group called the Daughters of the Confederacy had participated in the fundraising for the initial Silent Sam 106 years ago, and that there had been some quote-unquote promise that it would stand forever, that somehow conferred a right upon the Daughters of the Confederacy that they could somehow vindicate in court, and that they were then able, on their own motion, to just hand that off to this group called the Sons of Confederate Veterans, who would then have standing to come to bring a lawsuit against the university over its disposal of this white supremacist statue. And that's fanciful. As any reasonable lawyer with any training would tell you, that's not how standing works. Can't be conveyed that way. They didn't even have it in the first place. And so there really was no basis for bringing a lawsuit. Indeed, the head of the Sons of Confederate Veterans stated that in a letter to his members, hey, we really didn't have standing to bring this lawsuit.
Well, and I feel like, number one, I have to clarify, you know, these Confederate groups, these historical groups, the Daughters of the American Revolution, the Confederate groups that Rob has mentioned, yet these are not white supremacist groups. These are, you know, history groups. I think it's unfair to the discussion to put those kind of labels in this. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I'd like to point out with this whole thing is the lack of transparency, and particularly the $2.5 million settlement that was made. And, you know, this was done behind closed doors. It was done over a weekend. I don't know how it was done.
Well,
you know, to be honest
stinks.
With you,
that's undeniable.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, particularly when you're using public funds for these, and all of these university funds, whether they came from taxpayers or whether they were donated to the university through philanthropic channels, are public money. And so those decisions need to be made out in the open. They need to be transparent. It doesn't mean you're going to get the right answer, an answer that Rob and I are going to agree on. But I think that the big thing that's missing in this, and one reason why it's such a mess, and why there's so much mistrust about this, is because of the lack of transparency in the way this has been dealt with.
I'll just say, you want to check out the website of the Sons of Confederate Veterans and tell me that that's not a white supremacy group. The stuff that they have on there about Mitch and I talked about this last week at length on this program, and believe me, read it and you'll.
Rob cited a couple of examples last week. I mean, from the research and the reading I've done, I don't think that these groups are all equal or all created the same. I don't think that some of these groups are the ones that are doing reenactments and involved in the town square to memorialize and remember people who fought in these battles. I think some of them are taking a very different approach.
Fair enough. And there are certainly lots of different factions on both sides, or multiple sides of this issue.
Finally, impeachment. I would be remiss if I did not mention it. I will probably only irritate myself and the both of you if we spend too much time talking about it. But is there anything that hasn't been said this week?
Go ahead.
Not just this week, but, you know, the last 3 months. And, you know, don't forget, I mean, today the House Judiciary Committee voted on it. I think we're expecting to see a vote in the full House next week.
Yep.
Is that right? And then it goes over to the Senate. And they're hoping that it'll finish up by the end of January, I understand. So we're still – we haven't heard the last of it.
But is there anything that hasn't been said on impeachment?
I don't think so.
I think the only thing I would add is that I think there is a hope that some reasonable Republicans in the U.S. Senate, perhaps even including Senator Richard Burr, will allow the trial to proceed as it should be, to allow all of the evidence to be heard, to not allow Mitch McConnell to sidetrack the proceedings or to take it in one of these strange directions he's talked about in terms of admitting evidence and what's going to be allowed to be heard. There are people like Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins and other sort of semi-middle-of-the-road Republicans who I think understand that there is a constitutional duty here to actually have a real trial. That's what the Constitution directs, and not to have it sidetracked as has been forecast in some ways. Even during the Clinton impeachment, there was a real trial. We heard the evidence. People were testified. That's the kind of thing that needs to happen. We understand Senator Tillis is not going to listen to the evidence. He's already decided what he thinks. But we would hope that Senator Burr, who's been more notably silent on it, might take a more responsible position.
Your quick civics lesson here is that it takes a majority in the U.S. House to impeach, but it takes two-thirds of senators in order to expel. Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your weekend.
You too.
Thanks.
You can hear a portion of this conversation each Friday afternoon at 4:50 on WUNC Radio. That's during All Things Considered. If you already subscribe to the podcast, a big thank you. Feel free to pass it along to a colleague, friend, family member, somebody who you think would be well-served to engage a little bit further in state politics. Remember, you can find the program as well at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We drop the podcast twice a week now. And on Tuesday, we'll release a conversation with Henry Fry, former Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff. Talk to you again soon. Stand at the crossroads.